I get to close it out. I will counter Dr. Smith a little bit. He said, I'm not going to follow the rules and I'm not going to show you any evidence. But I would say that the evidence you presented was overwhelming, albeit in a visual manner, as typical for a plastic surgeon. So I'm going to talk about the legacy of what you just heard. You know, I think we can, after hearing these three outstanding speakers, we can all agree that you see surgeons learning, evidence being presented, and the critical role that partnerships played in that. So we've all seen this, Hippocrates, if you want to go to war, follow a surgeon. And we've tried to advance on that over the last 15 years of conflict. You know, and out of these conflicts, medical advances come, as Justin said, some positive, some negative. I threw this quote in, and I actually took this from a front of Cushing's book, which I was generously given to me by Ken Kelleher. And it says, the marrow of tragedy is concentrated in the hospitals, whether it is their mothers and sisters cannot see them, cannot conceive, and never conceive these things. Much of a race depends on what it thinks of death and how it stands personal anguish and sickness. That was from Walt Whitman describing the Civil War, but I think we'd all agree that holds true today. So you heard a little bit about this background. I'm just going to throw it again because some other people came in the audience and didn't hear Justin's talk. Just one slide. Again, World War I, 10 to 13 million deaths. You know, I mentioned at the beginning, you know, conflicts between peer and near peer enemies. Think of conflicts in Korea or China or in Russia with tens of thousands of casualties. I mean, these numbers are overwhelming to us. The Battle of the Somme itself, there were 600,000 British and French casualties, 300,000 German casualties. In the first day, there were 21,000 British killed in action and 40,000 wounded in action. Having been deployed to Afghanistan and at one of our busier hospitals, we had 1,000 casualties in 6 months, and that was a lot. Couldn't imagine that. The war's going on. We're on the sidelines, as you all know from history, but we're thinking. And the United States sends military observers, and you've heard a little bit about this from the units, medical participants to Europe from 14 to 17. And two people stand out, and we'll talk about them in a second, but George Crowell, from January to March of 1915, takes a team from Cleveland's Lakeside Hospital and joins the Ambulance Americaine in Paris, and then comes back. And then next up, the Harvard unit stands up and goes from April to June, and they go to Neuilly in France. And they really come back and recognize that, you know, that we need to be ready. But we don't enter the war until April 2nd, 1917, where we have, and as Justin mentioned, you know, a relatively light casualty count of 115,000 killed in action. So some of these, you know, visionaries at the beginning of the conflict really set the stage for our success. And the three that I really wanted to highlight was George Crowell, Harvey Cushing, and William Gorgas. So George Crowell was an Army reservist in the Spanish-American War, so he had a military background. For those of you that don't, you know, that knew or don't know, you know, he moves to Cleveland to Case Western Reserve in the Lakeside Hospital and really stands up the Cleveland Clinic and the concept after the war. He deploys as the World War I professional director, you know, kind of running the practice plan, for lack of a better term, and gets rapidly promoted from major to colonel in essentially a year, year and a half. We already heard about Harvey Cushing, you know, Yale Medical School, Halstead Residency, this tremendous pedigree, professor of surgery at Harvard, you know, at a young age in 1912, the surgeon chief of the Peter Brent Brigham in 1911. He becomes the neurosurgical surgery consultant and get rapidly promoted to colonel, gets a Distinguished Service Medal, and I'll mention at the end a monograph you can read about his experience, which is worth a perusal. And then, you know, on the military side of the house, William Gorgas, who was the U.S. Surgeon General during the war years, so from 14 to 18, he was completely integrated with American medicine, having served as the president of the AMA from 1909 to 1910. He really gained prominence with his role as chief sanitary officer in the Canal Project with Major Walter Reed, but he recognized the importance of academic medicine and these partnerships. And when Crowell came back and said, hey, we should have these Army hospitals, and the Army hospitals should be organized from existing large, well-organized civilian hospitals, Gorgias got it. And he orders three prominent reserve component officers to form the original three Army base hospitals. You've heard about the Harvard unit and the Kansas unit. These were the first three. So Crowell leading a team out of Cleveland, Cushing coming from Boston, and actually an intern as J.M. Swan from Rochester. The Harvard Base Hospital 3 arrives in France in 1917 in May. There's a picture of that unit on the slide. It gets incorporated into the British Base Hospital. And it's very shortly after. It gets there, you know, kind of late May. Within about a week and a half, they get 1,000 casualties in a week from the Battle of the Messines Ridge. Talk about a, you know, crucible. And remember, I just told you in Afghanistan, kind of the busiest time, we saw 1,000 casualties in 6 months. And this partnership that got formed in World War I wasn't unique to the United States. The Canadians also recognized the power of sending academic physicians to war and then reporting that this report of the transfusion of whole blood, which Dr. Cancer reported mentioned, comes from the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. So I want to bring you from that, you know, foundation in World War I up to where we are now. So World War I ends, the Great Peace, but of course we come back to World War II. And out of the crucible of World War II, the Excelsior Society is formed by the surgeons that had participated in the Mediterranean theaters of operations. And, you know, for those of you that have seen the growth or the rebirth of the Excelsior Society, you've seen this slide before. I just wanted to highlight it for those of you that haven't. You know, all the folks that had served in that Mediterranean theater, been through combat, formed this surgical club and becomes a society in 1951. Becomes, you know, a venue for folks to get together. They would have a meeting once a year at one of these academic medical centers. They wanted to make sure that there was a good football game that they could see and prepare for relaxation. And they form, they start the Churchill Lecture to show appreciation for Edward Churchill's contribution. And that Churchill Lecture is dedicated to original work. Dr. Dimitriadis gave the Churchill Lecture early this morning talking about partnerships and advances from the union between military and civilian surgery. Dr. Churchill really deserves a slide of his own. If you haven't read Surgeons of Soldiers, it's out of print, but you can get it on Amazon, or if you want a copy, come talk to me. You can borrow mine. Remarkable. You know, he was an academic surgeon from MGH. He was president of the American Surgical from 46 to 47. And he was a consultant to the Mediterranean Theater and really pushed the envelope of the surgical management of the wounded from World War II. And then, you know, after World War II, we run into a stretch of, obviously, Korea, Vietnam, and Desert Storm. And it's really, in my mind, both Dr. Rich and Dr. Pruitt that, you know, kept the pilot light on with these partnerships and between military and civilian medicine, you know, bring forth that academic tie and the criticality of military medicine and trauma care. Both individuals are largely responsible for the success that we've seen lately. And, you know, the American College of Surgeons, you know, recognizes this, forms the Committee on Trauma that's established in 1979, and that really starts to build the civilian infrastructure with respect to a trauma system. Many of you have seen this slide. For those of you who don't, this is kind of the lessons that have been learned over the past 15 years of conflict. We started these conflicts with a case fatality rate or a mortality rate somewhere around 15-16%, and we're able to drive that down to 5-6% despite increasing injury severity, largely based on this interchange or interplay of knowledge between both of our communities. And that knowledge sharing really includes things like tourniquets, damage control surgery, damage control resuscitation, and is extended not only from the civilian sector into the military, but really has come full circle most recently with the Stop the Bleed campaign and the Harvard consensus, where those lessons learned out of the battlefield are now ubiquitous and available, here at home. One key enabler of this has been the strategic partnership between the American College of Surgeons and the military health system. This partnership was signed in 2014 between Dr. David Hoyt as the executive director of the college and Dr. Jonathan Woodson, a vascular surgeon professor of surgery at BU, who was at the time the assistant secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, essentially the civilian in charge of our military health system. And this partnership was really founded on a shared ethos, recognizing that bond that goes back to World War I. That partnership also has been expanded by trauma training platforms. These trauma training platforms, which there are several, think of C-STARS in Cincinnati and Baltimore and St. Louis, the Army Training Center in Miami, the Navy Training Center, which we heard from this morning during the Churchill lecture, the teams that have worked at UNLV. These partnerships really are at the height of us being prepared, both home and on the battlefield. And this all kind of starts to come together with the NASEM report. The National Academies of Science and Engineering and Medicine, about 2 years ago now, gave us a charge. They said, create a national trauma care system with a goal of zero preventable deaths, where there's overlapping between the military system and the civilian system, where there's shared aims, instructions, pledges, design, leadership, and personnel. And that really, that really is the advancement of that vision that was set forth by our predecessors 100 years ago. In addition to that, we've reformed the Excelsior Society. The Excelsior Society now is a vibrant society within the college. We had our third annual meeting on Sunday. We had over 350 participants. And we hope this to be a forum for not only for exchange of information, but for a home for military surgeons and a place for us to interact with our civilian colleagues. Just a couple acknowledgments, not just on the my lecture, but on this whole session. Dr. Rich for being, an outstanding mentor. Dr. Pruitt for charging me with this. And Ken Kelleher for providing a copy of Cushing's manuscript, Cushing's book. I also recommend that as another read next to Churchill's. I don't know Michael Carey. He's a neurosurgeon out of New Orleans, but he wrote two phenomenal papers about Cushing, one of which will be a little deflating when you read, but is worth the read. And then my co-panelists, Lee Cancio, Dave Smith, and Justin Barr, and Dr. Matthew Bradley, who's one of our up-and-coming trauma surgeons, is supposed to be here with us, but he is deployed on the USNS Comfort, serving his country. Thank you very much, and I think we have time for questions. So any questions from the group? Lee, you were helping the AV guy when I asked this question previously, and it comes up all the time with leadership. Oh, we should basically forget everything that we did before because the next war is going to be so different. I think, honestly, we're at risk of both. Basically, forgetting the advances that we've made, but also risk of falling into the trap of doing what we did before. So how do we avoid that?
Well, I think like everyone in the group here, there is value in studying those who went before us, who, in brief, did a lot more with less. And so in reviewing these articles and learning about these advances, like I said, I asked myself, how is it possible that these people made these leaps forward in combat surgical care, et cetera? And I believe it was based on a rigorous approach to the science of surgery. And I think it would be a mistake. I think it's tempting to reduce surgery to an art whereas this meeting, the Clinical Congress, and our other scientific meetings emphasize that surgical practice has to be grounded in science and in intellectual discourse and in the exchange of ideas. And I think if we want to be leaders in surgery or in military surgery, we have to make that our charge.
Thank you. Well said. Dr. Pruitt. Yeah,
so
Dr. Pruitt asks, you know, what were the challenges to establishing a military trauma registry? Obviously, records were initially kept of casualties on an individual basis during World War I, a little bit during World War II. Dr. Norman Rich obviously established the Vietnam Vascular Registry, but these things were episodic. And it wasn't until the last conflict that the DoD trauma registry was developed. Any thoughts from the panel about, you know, why did it take 100 years for us to really start recording, these into a compiled fashion that we could share?
Well, I think that we are potentially the victims of what's known as the Whiggish theory of history. Namely, things are going to get better and better all around the world. And we won't have to relive the lessons of the past. Whereas I think it's time we admit that World War I was succeeded by World War II. And if that's the case, then the Whiggish theory of history is not true. And we have to be prepared for big wars and lots of casualties. And we have to maintain the infrastructure to include these registries in between conflicts.
Well, I'd never heard of that theory of war, but I will tell you that, you know, our nation has spent more time in conflict than not at conflict. And I think our opportunity in front of us is, you know, to follow the vision that was laid out by the National Academies and aligned the Military Trauma Registry with the National Trauma Data Bank. And that will ensure, you know, that it's there for us moving forward. Sir.
My name is Rich Mullins from Portland, Oregon. And I want to thank the panel for their informative presentations. I think there was a repetitive theme of devastating severe injuries being treated as best they could, but is not the principal duty of the military healthcare system to maintain the fighting efficiency of the force in the field? That is to say, can you comment on what lessons were learned about treating relatively minor or straightforward injuries so that that highly trained soldier could go back to the front lines? Isn't that really the goal of the number one goal of the military medical system?
So I'll take the first stab and I'll turn it over to the panel. You know, you're essentially asking how do we ensure that we're ready for what's described. And you know, leveraging this military-civilian partnership that we've talked about, we've developed a clinical readiness project that really, you know, focuses on three or four key elements. Number one is ensuring that folks have a robust practice. You can't do this stuff unless you take care of sick patients and operate. Number two, establishing a knowledge base and a way to assess that knowledge base. If you operate, you know, in a vacuum with that knowledge, you will not get the optimal care. And then looking at, you know, what are those gap skills? You know, what do we expect these folks to do in that environment that they wouldn't do in routine practice? And having ways to both teach and assess those skills, and built into all of that the ability to remediate or retrain folks and get them up to speed as quickly as possible. So I think we are, you know, we acknowledge that's a critical gap, and we're trying to fill that. But fill that by partnering with the college as opposed to doing it without our partners. Any other comments on that?
Well, the other thing is that we didn't talk about, although Justin, you touched on it, the non-surgical issues that affected the readiness of the force, which were very, very important. Trench fever a lice-borne disease, trench foot, influenza, dysentery. And this, these were certainly as devastating as the combat wounds that we've been talking about.
Last question, sir.
Thank you, Vivian McAllister. First, as a Canadian who's served with the U.S. forces, I want to acknowledge the leadership role that you've given us and helped in all the tasks that we had to do. You asked a question about not repeating errors of the past, and one I'd like to bring up, we have this system of clinical practice guidelines, which is almost the exact opposite to what the surgeons going into the First and Second World Wars had, and I stand to be corrected on it, but they had orders to do something, and many of those orders were designed on previous conflicts, and as you've just pointed out, a few that were in error, and to change those orders took a lot of courage because you face military discipline to underdo it. Now, with our clinical practice guidelines, we do have them ever-changing. They're starting from the bottom up rather than orders down, but we're at the same risk, of course, of creating a situation where you have to follow a line of care that you know is probably incorrect, and I think that's one of the things that we have learned, but we need to continue to learn all the time.
Yeah, thank you, Vivian. And you'll notice that I did have a slide about the contributions that our real partners from the North have given to this effort. You know, if you look at the clinical practice guidelines on the bottom, it says not the substitute for good clinical judgment. And that's there for a reason. So we get out of the orders. And the orders that Dr. McAllister refers to are things like, you know, you will not do this, or you will create an ostomy in every single patient. And, you know, that leadership style being as directive is probably not the best. I think the clinical practice guidelines are a tremendous resource. We need to continually update them on a cycle like we've been doing. And then that feeds all the things that I mentioned before. Does anyone else on the panel want to make a comment about that? Well, with that, I think we're right on time. I thank you all very much for attending.